Hi, welcome to this week's program. So, what's your biggest fear about retirement? If you're like most Americans, running out of money is right at the top of the list. According to a recent survey, only healthcare concerns topped money issues on the fear scale. You know, without financial strength in retirement, you could spend your later life scurrying around to make a buck or become a burden to your family. And financial strength requires some things. It requires saving a large enough nest egg. It requires investing those savings properly through appropriate asset allocation and then choosing the right securities. But for your nest egg to last the rest of your life, you also must defend yourself against the most pernicious wealth stealer of all time. Who am I talking about? Uncle Sam. Smart tax planning, therefore, can make a huge difference between you living your last years in dignity or becoming a ward of your family, or even worse, a ward of the state. You probably have a number of accounts to tap for income in retirement. Usually it's a 401k, or if you're a teacher, a 403b, or an IRA. Maybe you have a Roth IRA, or maybe a Roth 401k. While the accounts I just mentioned are either tax-deferred or tax-free, you may also have some taxable investment accounts too. Maybe you have a savings account. But which account should you draw on to minimize Uncle Sam's bite? That's what I'm going to talk about today. So to keep your taxes as low as possible, you have to know what tax bracket you're in. This is a calculation that you should do every year, because if you don't know it, you can't devise an appropriate tax management strategy. Now, your income determines your tax bracket. I think we all know this. And most retirees have at least two primary sources of income, Social Security being one, and the required minimum distribution, also known as the RMD, that they take from their IRA. Your RMD is just what it sounds like. Now, based on a new law, at age 72, you must begin withdrawing money from your IRA. If you don't do it, there are stiff penalties. And the IRS determines how much you have to withdraw each year. It's based on the value of your IRA divided by a factor from the IRS minimum distribution worksheet, which is a simple table where you can find your number. And by the way, we'll provide a link to it on our website. That number or factor is based on your life expectancy. So to keep the math simple, let's say you've got $1 million in your IRA and you're 72 years old. You go to the table and you find that your factor is 25.6. Well, all you do is divide $1 million by 25.6, and your RMD requirement comes to just over $39,000. That's the amount you take out of your IRA, and that's the amount that will be taxed as ordinary income. Now you can calculate your total taxable income. You combine your RMD amount with your Social Security benefits, add any pension income as well as interest, dividends, and capital gains, and then subtract any anticipated deductions. The number you end up with will tell you what your tax bracket will be. By anticipating your future bracket, you can now take advantage of some strategies to lower your tax bill. Do you see how we got to this point? Okay, generally, it makes sense to withdraw funds from taxable accounts before you dip into your tax-deferred retirement accounts. That's because the money in a tax-deferred account keeps compounding without tax until you make a withdrawal. When you make a withdrawal, the money is taxed as ordinary income. Still, the tax-free compounding is a huge benefit. It allows the account to grow faster than a non-tax-exempt account, so the money lasts longer. Another reason to hit your taxable accounts first is because they get more favorable tax treatment. You may, for example, pay a lower tax rate on capital gains or dividends. But keep in mind that a more favorable tax treatment doesn't mean you pay no taxes, it just means that you pay lower taxes. Let's say you have a mutual fund and you're reinvesting capital gains and dividends to buy more shares. Even though you are reinvesting, you still owe the taxes on the distributions of the fund and on the stock dividends in your account that you may also be reinvesting. Now, there are times when it makes more sense to tap retirement accounts first. If, for example, you're under age 72, the RMD rules haven't yet kicked in. As a result, you may now be in an unusually low tax bracket. So by withdrawing from your retirement accounts first, you can take advantage of the lower bracket until the RMDs begin. Doing this will reduce the amount of your RMD later because the account balance will be smaller. See how that works? And if you don't need the money now, you can stash it in a Roth IRA or take it later tax-free. You may also want to tap your retirement accounts first if you have highly appreciated assets in your taxable accounts. Let's say you bought Google at the IPO at a price of 85, you wish. And today Google changes hands at around $1,400 a share. So despite favorable long-term capital gains treatment, the tax liability on the sale would be huge. You should always be aware of your current tax bracket and also have a good idea of how your bracket is likely to change. That will tell you how much you should be withdrawing from your retirement accounts each year. If possible, for example, you'd expect to be in a lower tax bracket in the future, you should take as little as possible from your retirement accounts between now and then, and absolutely no more than your RMD each year. But if you expect to be in a higher bracket, it makes sense to take advantage of your income bracket by withdrawing more than the minimum, even if you don't need the income. Should you withdraw funds from your traditional IRA first or from your Roth? Once again, it depends on your tax bracket. Use the traditional IRA first if you're in a low tax bracket. Use the Roth if you're in a high tax bracket, because remember, Roth distributions are tax-free. Okay. As you start to tap your retirement accounts for income, be mindful of your asset allocation. It can easily get out of balance. This is important. Let's say you hold the majority of your stocks in a taxable account to take advantage of lower capital gains rates. By withdrawing money from that account first, you could soon find yourself dramatically underweight in equities, and this will diminish the growth in your nest egg. So finally, when you recalculate your tax bracket in December every year, check your asset allocation too and rebalance as necessary. Remember, the IRS table will be a link on the website, which is stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our weekly update. That's stevepomerantz.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. You know, the Florida that we know today, especially from South Miami to Palm Beach, has seen the kind of uncontrolled growth that is basically, in fact, seen as normal for life around here. Yet this unique growth trend started very early indeed. As a matter of fact, it started so early that most of us don't even know the history of how we got here and the booms and busts which were created by literally just a few men. Names you might have heard of because some islands in Miami are named after them, counties in West Florida are named after them, but not that much has really been written about them. Well, that's just changed due to this new book entitled The Florida Boom of the 1920s, How It Brought on the Great Depression. And the author is Christopher Knowlton, and Christopher Knowlton joins me today. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, Steve. The true title is Bubble in the Sun.
Bubble in the Sun. Sorry about that. Bubble in the Sun, The Florida Boom of the 1920s, How It Brought on the Great Depression. Thank you for that change. So who are these men that we're talking about? I mean, I know one is Madison Meisner, as we are here in Boca Raton, but Henry Flagler, who was involved initially with Standard Oil, was a big driver here. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, sure. He really was the first of the great Florida developers. He came to Florida, 20, 30 years before the others. But he provided the kind of template for how you could do real estate development, resort development, including golf courses, but really resort development. He first built an enormous railroad. He had retired from Standard Oil, where he'd made an enormous fortune. And he was just looking for something else to do. He was still a relatively young man in his very early 50s and eager to do something new and something that he had complete control over. Mm-hmm. So he built this railroad down the length of the coast, the East Coast. I think most people probably know this story, the Florida East Coast Railroad.
Yeah.
But he provided really the model for how to do it. And of course, real estate development is dependent on having good railroads and good roads. So that infrastructure that he built was kind of the backbone that set us up for the really great boom, which was the boom after the First World War in the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties.
Right.
And nowhere did it roar more than in Florida. And the book is really about these four great developers of that period. And then as a counterpoint to them, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, who is the great environmentalist of the period, who would go on to write the great book on the Everglades. And the two are really inextricably involved, economic development and environmental development.
Henry Flagler basically created the Breakers Hotel in Palm Beach. He kind of invented Palm Beach. That was really the first stop from his train. And he built his own house, Whitehall, which is now a museum and has been for many years, which really started, from what I gather in the book, it started people thinking about, well, I don't have to go down to Florida and stay in a hotel. I can actually start building my vacation second home here. And is that, in your view, what started this boom?
Yes and no, Steve. He actually started in St. Augustine with the Ponce de Leon hotel, which was really as big a hotel as we had seen in America up until that time. And top-of-the-line service, but really targeted at a high-end audience and a wealthy clientele, the sort of Gilded Age barons of whom he was one. And all of his hotels, as he went down the coast, and he got all the way down to Miami, and he actually continued to build his train right on to Key West, but his hotels were really very high-end, and it wasn't until the 20s when the economy really took off that the opportunity emerged to build resort hotels for a middle-class audience.
Yeah.
And I tell the story of George Merrick in Coral Gables. He had plenty of high-end real estate that he was developing, but he is also targeting the middle class. The properties were more inland. They weren't right on the coast. And, and so the housing was much more affordable. And the dream, the American dream, kind of became available to everybody. But, you know, there were other factors feeding what eventually became a frenzy. It wasn't just the fact that there was sunshine and it was warm and it was undeveloped and real estate was appreciating, which always helps. But you had prohibition, but nowhere was prohibition less enforced than in Florida in the 1920s. And then, of course, they started to, you know, sell sex as well. And you have the great case of Carl Fisher advertising Miami Beach with scantily clad women in bathing suits for the first time. I mean, really, that was rather a novel thing. It's just one example of where the 1920s began to kind of create the contemporary culture we have today. But the sex sold, the booze helped sell real estate too. And then it all started to catch on.
Well, it was really the precursor of Vegas. I mean, it was basically the last frontier. It was kind of the Wild West. As you said, you know, the booze was flowing. The opportunities were seemed to be just endless. And, you know, the great real estate boom started happening. Banks came into town. They started building skyscrapers. Actually, it says in your book that you estimate that as many as 18 million people of middle-class means mostly risked their savings by investing in Florida real estate, where only 1.5 million in the country had brokerage accounts. So this kind of idea that more people were invested in real estate, especially the middle class, than the upper class, which had brokerage accounts and could invest in stocks, which of course, you know, is considered one of the reasons that the Great Depression started, the crash of the stock market and so on. But I think you make the case in your book that it really started earlier, and perhaps it started with, you know, the decline of Florida real estate. Let's talk about Carl Fisher a little bit more. He came out of the fringes of the automobile business. He built the Indianapolis Speedway, And he was really quite a marketing genius, right?
Well, he was. He was also a great road builder, because first he organized the construction of the Lincoln Highway, which was the first highway across the United States. And having had some success with that, he decided to build the Dixie Highway down to Miami from the east, northeast, and from the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And that highway, of course, you know, all real estate development is dependent on yeah. road building ultimately. And he knew that. And he was by then starting his second career, which was, of course, in real estate development in Miami Beach. So to have the road end in Miami Beach was, well, it served his interests very well.
Sure.
But he's a remarkably colorful character. He was a big boozer. He was a womanizer. He chain smoked cigars, and he really knew how to enjoy himself, and people loved him. He was a really rather endearing character. And all of these guys were very colorful, very different. And the sad thing is that they all come to a rather macabre end when it all goes belly up at the end. And I tell, of course, that story as well.
Yeah, I want to hear about that.
A lot of fun in the sun, but yeah. it doesn't end so well.
So the promise was to own a piece of Florida land. That almost sounded too good to be true. You could put 10, maybe 25% down and have a balloon note for the balance. And hey, if you wanted to flip that note for a big profit, go right ahead. Kind of, they didn't call it flipping back then. But that was really the beginning. And also, I think Carl Fisher said that he raised prices 10%. He was going to do that every single year. And that caused people to stand in line to sign up to get their piece of the so-called or hope for riches.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Steve. And that was an inspired piece of marketing on his part, because everybody was pretty sure they were going to make something on their investment. And who doesn't like a sure thing?
Right.
And Florida really did look like a sure thing. Now, I just want to correct one thing.
Sure.
We don't think it was 18 million who bought real estate in Florida. I think the more reasonable estimates is probably between 2 and 5. The interesting thing is that there's very little data that was collected about this, and there's very little data about mortgages and who was lending. And that's one of the reasons I think that the importance of the Florida boom to the broader economy and why it might have contributed or very likely contributed to the collapse of real estate nationally when it did finally roll over.
So during that time, Miami was growing exponentially. There were skyscrapers being built, homes like you mentioned, you know, George Merrick was building in Coral Gables, and that money had to come from somewhere. So it really mostly came from banks along with private investors. So tell us a little bit about the banking situation at that time.
Yeah, it was coming out of banks all around the country. I mean, people got Florida real estate fever in Massachusetts and in Ohio and various places where they started to pass laws to prevent people from buying these prospectuses and, you know, sight unseen. It mm-hmm. really quickly got out of hand. And as for the banks, just like in every other one of these booms, like in 2008,
yeah.
before long, the banks were directly involved. The bankers became, you know, promoters and developers. Mm-hmm. Developers became bankers. Mm-hmm. You had all the attendant conflicts of interest that always creates. And, you know, it wasn't long before gangsters were involved. I've got to talk about Al Capone in the book, but it quickly got an infusion of corruption, which tends to happen late in these booms.
It's the cycle. We saw the same thing. You know, it's a bit of a different color, but fundamentally, it's the same painting. When you look at 2008 and the bust of real estate, and you look at 1926, 27 and the bust of real estate, the same greed. We know we had the high levels of greed in 08. We had the banks doing anything just to sell properties. They lowered their lending standards. And it seems like human nature really doesn't change.
Yeah, no, that's right. And, you know, the financial innovation back then was actually the home mortgage and installment credit as well to buy your, you know, your Model T Ford or your car. There were other models by the end of the decade. But people were using debt for mortgages and for, you know, consumer credit to leverage themselves up. And that's kind of when that whole problem started. They weren't CDOs. They were very simple, straight, vanilla, 5 to 7 year mortgages back then.
Yeah,
but they certainly contributed mightily
to
what happened in the Great Depression.
Well, when you put 10% down and your leverage is 10 to 1, it doesn't take a whole lot of decline to wipe out that 10%. And that ripples throughout the financial economy, and that's what causes problems. The book is Bubble in the Sun, The Florida Boom of the 1920s and How It Brought on the Great Depression. The author is Christopher Knowlton, and he's joining me today. Let's briefly touch upon Addison Meisner, and then I want to get to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. Addison Meisner basically helped to create Palm Beach. I know we still see his architecture here in Boca Raton. And of course, he was responsible for building the Boca Raton Hotel. Tell us a little bit about Addison Meisner.
Yeah, Addison Meisner is a very winning character. He was a charming human being, and everybody who knew him adored him. He was a great raconteur and wit, and he was a very talented architect. He was kind of misperceived for a while as just a resort swell, but we can see now how good his buildings really were. And he got his start building the Everglades Club in Palm Beach for Paris Singer. It was a huge hit as a work of architecture. He attracted clients among America's, you know, very wealthy who were building homes in Palm Beach for the first time. They were kind of moving out of the old Flagler hotels and building homes of their own.
Right.
And he was right there at the right place at the right time. The problem was that he had a brother named Wilson Meisner, who was another great wit, but a real bona fide con artist. And he made the terrible mistake of involving Wilson in his business. And Wilson got him being an architect to a developer, you know, in an effort to make a big score for both of them.
Yeah.
Meisner himself was wealthy, but his brother was still looking for that great opportunity. And it was his brother who, in Boca Raton, you know, where they got overly exposed, where they were guilty of some financial shenanigans and overpromising, and one thing or another, the usual kind of, you know, borderline corruption, and one thing led to another, and it all came crashing down, and Meisner ultimately was bankrupt and a broken man when it was all over.
Yeah, I was looking it up, but in the bankruptcy proceedings, creditors received 0.1% on the dollar. For example, one paving company received $93 on a $93,000 claim. But if you can just, I can paint the hype here. On the first day of selling on May 14th, 1925, $2 million of properties were sold. And he would run buses from Worth Avenue in Palm Beach to Boca Raton. He also used seaplanes to transport potential buyers to the site. And he would exaggerate in his brochure that he had offices all over the country when in fact he really didn't. And it all came crashing down in 1927. Let's get to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, because she is kind of the antithesis of all of which we're talking about today. What is her background and what did she end up doing?
Yeah, she's really the conscience of the book. She arrives as a young woman, you know, around 1918, and her father is the founder of what becomes the Miami Herald. And she gets a job first as a society reporter for them, and she's the first woman reporter. She's interested in the Florida landscape right from the beginning. And through the 20s, she sees the devastation that starts to occur. Mm-hmm. And the great sort of symbol of what happens to the Everglades during this period is the building of the Tamiami Trail, which cuts right through the Everglades from one side to the other, trying to link Tampa to Miami, which would be great for real estate and great for the developers. And, you know, the newspapers are on the side of that. And first she is too, and then she, you know, she starts to see what's happening to the birds that she's fallen in love with and to the local pines. And before long, she really starts to develop a real environmental conscience. So I trace her evolution. It's kind of the making of an activist in the book. And she doesn't actually write her definitive work until 1947 on the Everglades. But in the 20s, she builds her own little bungalow. And so she's directly exposed to all of this too, and having her own experience with real estate, and she has a construction contractor who runs off with her money, and it's done through fits and starts. But she ends up leaving the newspaper and starting to write fiction for the Saturday Evening Post, and it's all the fiction features Florida and features its wildlife and its natural beauty, and she becomes really a terrific writer. So I view her as the kind of counterpart to the real estate developers of the era. And I think she kind of rounds out the story, because my argument in the book is that you can no longer separate economic development and economic well-being from environmental well-being. Mm-hmm. But those two are now, you know, merged at the hip.
Yet in Florida, development still seems to have the edge by far, I would say. Would you agree?
Well, I'm not sure I could comment on that. I'm more of a historian. I'm not up on exactly what's going on, but that wouldn't surprise me. Let me put it that way. I mean, even back then, the legislature, you know, and the state house was very much under the control of the business interests. And I think you see that in a lot of states around the nation.
Mm-hmm. Well, she was responsible for, in a sense, saving the Everglades and finally the creation of it as a national park. And the book you referred to, by the way, is called The River of Grass, for anyone who's interested. We're talking about Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. My guest is Christopher Knowlton. The book is Bubble in the Sun, The Florida Boom of the 1920s, How It Brought on the Great Depression. Real quick, Chris, so what started it in 1926 or 1927? What was the beginning of the end?
Well, there was this terrible hurricane that struck Miami square in the face. And a lot of the construction, of course, was very flimsy and done on the cheap, and that resulted in, you know, disastrous destruction. There was a second hurricane that hit Palm Beach about 2 years later that actually cost more lives, in particular the African-American farm workers who lived in the, you know, just below Lake Okeechobee. So some devastating hurricanes really sort of pointed up the environmental sensitivity of the area, which had really been overlooked by the developers. I mean, they'd eviscerated the Everglades, which is, you know, the great aquifer for Florida, very short-sighted from a development perspective. And then they built right along the coast where, you know, the hurricanes can hit. So it's very much a cautionary tale.
Very much so. The book, Bubble in the Sun, The Florida Boom of the 1920s and How It Brought on the Great Depression. I've been speaking with Christopher Knowlton. To hear this and any interview again, if you have any questions, we love your questions, by the way. Just visit our website, which is stevepomerantz.com, to join the conversation. While you're there, sign up for our weekly update where you can get all of this in your inbox every single week. All you have to do is go to the website, which is stevepomerantz.com, and put in your email address, and you'll be on the list. Christopher Knowlton, thank you so much for joining me today.
Steve, thanks. I've enjoyed it.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry's a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. You're back.
Yeah, I'm back.
Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks, Steve. Love being here.
You know, there's a lot of talk in the real estate industry about when you should be buying a house. I mean,
you know my answer.
What is your answer?
Now, Steve. Always now. Now's the time.
Best time to buy is now. Best time to sell is now. But all kidding aside, some months seem to be better than others. I know that people kind of want to move into a neighborhood before school starts and the like.
Sure.
But a lot of people don't want to list in the winter, and even down here, January, February. They want to wait till March or April. But the statistics show that that's actually not a very smart thing to do.
Right. According to the Realtor.com market report, it revealed that buyers in 20 of the 100 largest markets are beginning their home search now in January, when it used to be April. So it's moved from April to January, which basically what that tells me, Steve, is we know that there's low levels of inventory. So It's like that early bird catches the worm theory.
Yeah.
They're starting to look and take their home search seriously earlier on.
Yeah, because they need more lead time.
Yep.
That could be it too.
Yeah, they need more time.
You need more time now. So you don't have the luxury of waiting.
Right.
Huh.
Right.
Okay, good. You know, there's an old Shel Silverstein poem.
Right.
If you're a bird, be an early bird and catch the worm for your breakfast plate. If you're a bird, be an early bird. But if you're a worm, sleep late. So remember that.
I don't think I've ever heard that. Never thought about the poor worm. I always thought about the bird.
I'm always thinking about the worm.
Wow.
Okay, so what else can we talk about here? What do most sellers forget when prepping for a home sale?
Oh, there's a lot of things they forget.
Yeah. What, you know, it's funny because you may put away your jewelry.
Right.
Because you're thinking, well, I don't want to expose that. Someone might steal it. But there's other stuff, too, you have to think about.
Yeah, you know, people today, I mean, I never thought of this years ago, but it's prescription drugs.
Uh-huh.
And I can't imagine going and showing a house and rifling through their bathroom drawers and medicine cabinets.
Well, I can see opening up the medicine cabinet and closing it.
But, you know, apparently a lot of people leave. And I've seen that where they have a whole, you know, 20 bottles of prescription drugs sitting on their kitchen counter.
Yes, and some of those.
And so some of them can be, you know, addictive
Tylenol
drugs.
Tylenol with codeine.
Right.
Oxycontin.
Oxycontin.
You may not even know that you have that stuff anymore.
Right. So don't leave prescription drugs out. And Steve, one time I'll never forget, I had a gentleman, he had his Rolex. He must have come into the house and he left his Rolex on the kitchen counter with his cash.
Uh-huh. Cash and Rolex.
Cash and Rolex. So I was a nervous wreck as the listing agent.
Yeah.
All I did was I stood there to protect it. And I let the other agent, you know, walk the client around. I was like, I can't. I didn't even want to touch it or move it.
Right.
I don't want to be accused of moving it or touching it. Was I being baited to see if I would touch it? I don't know. So don't do that to your realtors or tempt any clients in any way, shape, or form.
You know, I mentioned Tylenol with codeine, and, you know, that's obvious, and OxyContin. But according to this article, it also says medications like Adderall for attention deficit disorder.
Sure.
I mean, that has some physical effects on when you take it. Depression, anxiety medication like Zoloft and Xanax, and also sleep aids like Ambien. So it doesn't have to be the hard drugs. It may be something you didn't even think about.
Sure.
Yeah, weird. All right. Let's see what else here. The fact is that real estate scams, especially online scams, are still rife.
Yes, they
are. And especially egregious, according to the article that we're talking about today, is Craigslist.
That's
right. Now, what are these scammers doing on Craigslist, which makes us so vulnerable?
So basically what they do is they hijack or copy listings that agents have. For example, I would have a property for rent. Or for sale, they steal the information.
So they kind of come in and they copy and paste.
They copy and paste
the listing, so they see that it looks professional.
Yep, it does. Okay. I've seen it.
Yeah.
And then they give false information how to reach them. It's usually for rent. It's always at a lower price.
Yes, I've seen that too. I mean, and I'll tell you, you know, there's people in financial places in their lives where they're really looking for a nice place, but they really just can't afford the current cost of renting, and then they see an ad, and it looks legitimate.
Yeah.
And instead of it being like $2,200 a month, it's like $1,400 a month. And you call the ad.
Right.
And as soon as you call.
And a legit sounding person says, well, send us a cashier's check.
That's right. As a deposit.
As a deposit. So we'll send you the keys or whatever. And they'll give you a long, lame story like, well, the owner left the keys. I'll have him mail them directly to you.
Yeah.
And I know this to be true because it's happened. And the way I know that it's happened is because the person who was scammed, they are about to be scammed. I actually have never been involved where they were scammed, but they came close to, well, they recognized the fraud, contacted me through the legitimate listing and asked me, is the property for rent? I'm like, no, where'd you see it? Now, as agents, we keep an eye out on this stuff, but it's widespread.
Yeah, it's impossible to see
everything.
Yeah, so again, it looks real. They take off the telephone number of the agency.
Right.
And they replace it with their own telephone number, and they do a little copy and pasting, a little Photoshopping, and they get something that looks pretty real. And so, you know, I guess it's under the too good to be true category.
Right.
If everything else is selling at a much higher rate, why would this property that's so nice?
Low.
And when you call, you might ask them that question and they go, well, because
the seller's desperate. They just had to move out of town real quick.
Exactly. They've just got to get this thing rented or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
All right. Real quickly, let's talk about homeowners insurance. A lot of people are undercovered. For example, if you have homeowners insurance where only 80% or less than 80% of your home replacement value is covered,
right,
you're going to be very unhappy if something serious happens.
Right. That's why they call it insurance. No, it's
people
really
don't
important.
Want to pay, though. They don't want to pay insurance.
You know, looking at this article, I don't think I've looked at my own policy in 4 or 5 years.
We've both said the same thing when we read this. We have to look at our policies.
And our home values have gone up.
Yes.
So replacement costs are a lot higher.
Okay. So there's the actual cost.
Right.
There's the depreciated cost of the stuff that you
have in
your house. That's no good.
No.
Because if you have a 10-year-old couch, you have to go out and buy a 10-year-old couch. That's not going to happen.
Yeah. Can you imagine if you had to replace every item in your house? I don't know how much stuff is, but let's say you have $100,000 worth of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Depreciated value is probably
$5,000
for everything you own.
I know. Think about that.
And then, you know, your house burned down.
Yeah.
You have to replace all your clothing at literally everything that you own.
Right. So replacement value are the keywords that you want to look for.
That's right.
And you want to take a look and you ask your agent to tell you what the rebuilding of your house would cost today.
Yeah.
Because they have the price per square foot.
It's a fortune. Does anyone know how expensive it is right now to build a house? It's high. Very, very high.
All right. So I think that's good advice. Check your insurance policy. And you and I are both going to do that. Next time we meet, we're going to compare notes on that.
And know that your insurance policy is going to go up.
My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Listening to the Steve Pomeranz Show. Here's a fact. About 1 in 5 women fall into poverty as a result of divorce. About 1 in 3 women who own a home and have children at home lose their homes. Men can also experience difficulty as well. Most men experience a loss in their standard of living in the years after a divorce, a loss generally between 10 and 40% depending on circumstances. So, we're going to talk today about the financial impact of divorce and discover smarter ways to handle this particular life crisis. So, I've invited Angie Hallier, a practicing divorce lawyer and a certified family law specialist. She is AV rated by Martindale Hubbell and authors a divorce education column. And she has a new book, The Wiser Divorce: Positive Strategies for Your Next Best Life, where she lays out a better way to handle this important and possibly expensive life-changing decision. Really, Angie, it was a great book. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. So glad to be talking to you.
You know, divorce is a life crisis in many ways. What is it about divorce that can create so much destruction and problems well into the future?
Well, you know, the number one thing is how people handle their emotions during the divorce. And we all know that divorce, you know, it gets a bad rap. It has this reputation for being a very expensive battle. And what makes it a very expensive battle when it is one is how people monitor their speaking, their actions, and their attitudes. And when they employ the right strategies for those things, it doesn't have to be a battle, and it doesn't have to be as expensive.
It used to be, I don't know, maybe even just 30 years ago, that in order to get a divorce, someone had to be at fault, and it was never spoken about in polite company, and it was kind of a shameful action. And, you know, the whole idea of divorce, though, has changed over the years. And you write in your book, I thought this was really quite interesting, that when it comes to getting married, the law treats us like grown-ups and trusts us to figure it out. But when it comes to divorce, the courts traditionally have the final say. How did it end up that way?
Well, you know, part of it is just the way people looked at divorce, again, as a battle. It's a lawsuit. And, you know, unfortunately, that's how you have to do it. Somebody has to sue somebody. Someone has to respond. And many times you ended up in front of the judge because the old mindset and the old mindset of attorneys was, you know, you go to court, you get your answers.
Mm-hmm.
So many things have changed today. There are so many different ways that people can go about ending this legal contract of marriage that don't require that.
So divorce, if it's a battleground that's going to be fought in the courts, someone's got to win and someone's got to lose, right?
Well, that's the myth. But that's not true. And one of the things we talk about in the book is how, you know, there really isn't a supreme commander of justice. People think if they go to court, they will be declared right, or they will get their revenge, or someone will just declare who's good and who's evil. And it's simply not the case. Judges are human like the rest of us. And when you trust your destiny in the hands of someone who may only see you for 3 hours
mm-hmm.
and who you're asking to decide the outcome of a 20-year marriage, you're not going to end up with what you want. And that's one of the key things to saving money in your divorce, is being smart about the process you use to end it.
You spend a chapter discussing the life of the average judge. You know, as lay people, we may go to court and we think, you know, he's really listening to my side of the story and able to really express and, you know, maybe ranting and raving a little bit, but he'll get me because I've been so unjustly treated. But, you know, the judge is sitting there. Just give us a quick idea of what the judge's day might be like.
Right. So if you're a divorce judge, all day long, day in, day out, you see people come before you who are arguing about things that, you know what, grown-ups normally wouldn't argue about. Whether your child can be in soccer, who's going to get the $50 savings account, things that just to the outside world, you can't imagine they're being asked to decide. Intimate things about your life. Mm-hmm. Then that's not enough for them. They have a pile of paperwork where everybody is arguing back and forth and back and forth. So they become, you know, they get really jaded. And even if you come before them and they think, wow, you're really sympathetic, they're restrained by the law as to what they can order and what they can't order. So, you know, they have very little time. They only hear the very relevant parts. They don't hear what a dirty scoundrel your soon-to-be ex is. And they're human. So put that all together and you get, you know, maybe not the best outcome.
My guest is Angie Hallier. She is a practicing divorce lawyer and the author of The Wiser Divorce, Positive Strategies for Your Next Best Life. I have read it and I do recommend it if you're going through this situation or contemplating it. It's an important book to read. Angie, though, you talk about setting aside emotion. You know, that's so easy to say, but hard to do, especially if you feel that you've been shamed or something the spouse has done that has hurt your feelings. It's very, very hard to put those emotions aside. What can we actually do? What are some first steps that a person can take to start to pull themselves together so they have the right outcome?
So one of the things I suggest is that you envision your divorce as a series of rooms. Because what I want people to do is be able to come into the divorce room, that room where you're actually just ending that contract, and put their emotions in another room, because those emotions aren't going to go away. But when you mix up your rooms and walk around all the rooms while you're trying to divide your assets and debts, and talking about your children, that's when it gets confusing. So envision that when you're with your attorney, when you're making decisions about your financial future, you're not mixing it up with these other emotions because you're going to have them. You know, the other thing I talk about is it really is like setting up a business. The matter of your divorce is a business. If you were starting a business, you would plan, you would execute, you would wisely spend your money, you would set goals. You need to do the same thing for that process of your divorce. The other thing is I mentioned using scripts. Training yourself to speak about your divorce in a certain way triggers your brain starting to think about it in a certain way. So I've got some advice in the book for using scripts as well. And then lastly, I mean, really sit down and do some worksheets about this. And we have that in the book as well. Think about what is the good you're going to take forward from your divorce, because I guarantee you there was some. Think about what things you never want to take forward that you had during your divorce. You know, what you didn't like that you're just going to lose and forget about. And then think about what those unfulfilled things are that you have inside you. Maybe it's time you wanted to spend with certain people you didn't, or experiences you want to have, and just focus on what that future can be, and that will really help.
I think a lot of people feel that settling in certain areas of the divorce, they're looking for a sense of fairness. And I'm going to give an example that you gave in the book. So often one party runs up a significant amount of debt without any consultation with the other spouse. So they just start using the credit cards and they build up debt. The spouse is perhaps unaware of it. And then in the divorce, the spouse has to assume his or her portion of the debt in divorce. And that just doesn't seem fair. Is achieving fairness truly the ultimate goal?
You know, you want people to be able to hold their head up when they're done and say, you know what, this was an outcome I can live with. But fair doesn't really exist in the law. Nothing is fair. I mean, if we go back, you think, hey, it was never fair. I fell in love with this guy or gal to begin with. So you need to change that thinking from fairness to what I can live with to gracefully end this marriage.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it's quite important to find the right attorney for this wiser divorce. How do you go about finding this person?
Right. And it's the right attorney for you because, you know, there are a lot of good attorneys out there. It's just like doctors. There's great doctors. There's not so good doctors. The same with attorneys. You need to find an attorney that immediately puts you at ease and makes you feel that they have your back. You need to find the attorney who's in the right price range for you because, you know, there's all hourly rates when you're looking at attorneys. If you have a simple case, you don't need the number one attorney in town. And if you have a very complicated case, you may need multiple attorneys working on your case. You have to consider all of those things. And for me, what makes the best attorney is what I think makes the best doctor. If you go to a doctor with a problem and they say, here's what you have, take this pill 5 times a week, come back and see me, you know, that's not really the best thing. You want a doctor that says, here's what I've identified you have. Here are the 4 options for treatment. Here is what you could expect from each option. And here is the option I recommend. And here's what you need to do your part in the treatment. That's what makes a good divorce attorney. So you need to look for someone like that.
You know, you write in the book that there's 10 ways to wise up about divorce. And I've listed them out here. So allow me to list them and you can explain. So number one is hire the right attorney. We've talked about that. Number two, which seems quite obvious, but I know in the emotion of the moment, this often does not take place. Number two is put your kids first.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it is amazing because so many people come in and say, now listen, my children are my number one priority. And then they act in ways that make it clear they're not their number one priority. You have this obligation as a parent, quite honestly, no matter what age your kids are, to shield them from the litigation, to not let them be involved, to not guilt them, to not engage them in the battle, to not see you drowning in sorrow, to protect them and keep them safe, and to co-parent with the other parent. So that's what they see. And it's hard for people because, you know, there are so many emotions and they do feel maybe so angry at the other parent.
Yeah.
But, you know, people that really love their children will do things and go to the ends of the earth for them. And divorce is a really important time to do that.
It takes a lot of self-control to not rag on your soon-to-be ex with the children and say, you know, he did this or she did that. I mean, that I can tell you want to say it. It takes a lot of self-control to stop that. Number three here is prioritize your goals. That sounds so kind of businesslike and cold, but explain it with regards to divorce.
Right. So, you know, we always look at what will happen if you do have to have a judge decide things. And a judge can't prioritize what's most important to you. Maybe you want your house, but maybe you also want a certain amount of child support. You know, which one is more important to you? When you settle your case, you can prioritize and focus on those number one goals for you because you're going to have, you know, 10, 20 maybe decisions to make to end this legal contract of marriage. So if you look at settlement, you have the opportunity to see what's really what's most important to you, prioritize that, and make sure you get those gains.
You know, one listing here that I really liked, which was subtle, but I think it's actually pretty important, is understand your settlement options. So, you know, we tend to think a possibility of thinking that, you know, that you can kind of get the moon. But if you know kind of what your settlement options are, you know the parameters and what you can operate and then what to expect, I think it would be easier to make decisions.
It's absolutely easier to make decisions. And that's what a good attorney will do. They will outline for you what probably your best and worst case scenario is at court, what the likely outcome is, and also define those confines within which a judge must order things. A settlement gives you so many opportunities for creativity that are not available. Just as an example, you know, most judges in states will give you spousal maintenance for a certain number of months, if you're entitled to it, in a certain amount. Judges don't have the ability to lump sum that forward. When we're looking at a settlement about maintenance, many times I've settled cases where we decide we're going to give significantly more assets and or cash to a spouse who's entitled to maintenance right up front, so they have the flexibility to use that money as they want, and so that the other adult doesn't have to keep writing them checks every month. That's an example of what you can do when you settle instead of go to court.
Yeah, and also the receiving spouse doesn't have to kind of be waiting for the check every month and have to maybe change her or his, you know, attitude towards the ex-spouse. And it helps to get on with your life if you can just, you know, give a lump sum and just cut the cord. We don't have all the time in the world. My guest is Angie Hallier. She wrote The Wiser Divorce, Positive Strategies for Your Next Best Life. Number 9 here is follow your attorney's advice. It's listed, follow your attorney's advice, follow your attorney's advice, follow your attorney's advice. What are you trying to say?
Follow your attorney's advice is kind of what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
But it is amazing. You know, people pay their attorneys all this money and they rely on them. And when they do not follow their attorney's advice, they're making a mistake because, you know, like me, I have been through thousands of divorces. I know how things you do now play out in the end. So even if it doesn't make sense to you now, listen to me.
We have about 2 minutes left, and I just want to get to some of the kind of the end thoughts here because, again, it's all in the book. But to you, Angie, what is a perfect divorce and how would you achieve it in about a minute and a half?
Right. So the perfect divorce is one where you come out at the end of your divorce and you know what your plan is for the future. You know where you're going to go. You know how much money you have and you haven't spent excess money you shouldn't spend during the process and you have it to live your next best life.
Yeah. And that's really the key. It can turn into a financial nightmare, and you want to, like everything else in your life, start to take control of your finances. And in a situation where it can be so devastating when you're making these life choice decisions, by far, you want to be very careful and very smart when it comes to divorce. If this is going to be a win-lose situation, if you're going to go to court and rack up all these bills, you have to really think, what are we going to have left after this whole process is over and done with? What is left for me to live my one best life? My guest is Angie Hallier, and that is spelled H-A-L-L-I-E-R. And she can be found at AngieHallier.com. Angie, thank you so much for sharing your time.
Thank you, Steve, so much.
Listening to the Steve Pomeranz Show. I recently came across a T. Rowe Price study which stated that claiming Social Security at 70 can cost you. Now, many retirees wonder if they should delay receiving their Social Security benefits until age 70. You know, your benefit grows by about 8% a year if you wait. So many who can think seriously of taking this route. However, waiting until age 70 to make sure you maximize your benefits may undermine retirement income, so says T. Rowe Price in their article. Though most Americans claim benefits early, which, by the way, leaves a lot of money on the table for the Social Security system, which helps out the Social Security system, some more savvy and disciplined Americans delay claiming until age 70 to maximize their benefits. Again, the problem is, though, that they may be undermining their retirement income unwittingly. What the Price study found was that what it calls a split strategy may hold the greatest advantage for an average couple. In that approach, a lower-earning spouse claims Social Security at age 62, while the higher earner takes the spousal benefits at full retirement age of 66. Now, he's not taking his own benefits, he's taking the spousal benefits at age 66, and delays his own benefits until age 70. This is called the file and suspend strategy, and this is a nuance to this file and suspend strategy. Now, how can this be better than both waiting to claim maximum benefits to age 70? The reason, according to T. Rowe Price, is that there are two key financial inputs in the financial equation. There is the Social Security benefit, and there's also the couple's retirement savings. You don't want to dip into savings more than you have to, they say. If you use the wait and collect strategy, chances are that's exactly what you'll be doing, is you'll be dipping into your savings to make up the difference. Now, especially if both partners wait until they're 70, this forces an average couple to dip into their savings in order to hang on until age 70, resulting in $80,000 more in retirement account withdrawals on average. So the split strategy would avoid that to a large degree. So because you're withdrawing more from your savings, this strategy needs to be carefully considered. The split strategy, in essence, is all about integrating when you claim your Social Security in light of the retirement account withdrawals. You think of the two of them together. So it's important to focus on the front end and perhaps delay dipping into savings, which this split strategy does. And what you're doing also about the back end is making sure that whoever survives gets the highest possible benefit from Social Security for the rest of their life. You want to optimize for the survivor, and the split strategy does that. Now, here's the biggest takeaway. Whether you take the split strategy, which once again is having the lower earning spouse claim Social Security benefits at age 62, while the higher earner takes the spousal benefit at 66, delays taking his own benefits until age 70, or you use the maximize strategy as with both of you waiting to age 70, both are significantly preferable to the early strategy, which although it pays you the least, it does pay you something starting 4 years earlier. But when you do the math over a lifetime, those two other strategies are better than taking the early strategy. So for most of you who plan on claiming early, and you're in big company because upwards of 70% of Americans claim Social Security benefits at age 62, you should try to be in with the minority who take their money at age 70 or use a more nuanced strategy that I just discussed. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform, and of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.